Hello and welcome to Giving Ventures, a podcast to help you grow your giving and change the world for the better. Each episode, we share innovative charitable efforts leveraging private philanthropy to solve public problems. I'm your host, Peter Lipset, Vice President at Donors Trust. This show is a product of Donors Trust, the oldest and largest donor advised fund focused on helping conservative and libertarian donors of all capacities simplify, protect, and grow their giving. My colleagues and I talk with a lot of groups doing great work. This show lets us share a bit of what we learned with you so you can discover new projects for your own philanthropy. We often spend our time on Giving Ventures looking at specific issues, but today we're going to back the lens up a bit and look at the broader charitable landscape. There is a lot going on in the philanthropic world. Things like giving seems to be down across the board and is particularly down among smaller donors. There's also these debates about how gifts should even be structured, with a push for more general operating money instead of restricted gifts. And of course, there's always tax and legislative things going on with proposed rules and regulations coming at a time when comments denigrating philanthropy are really coming from both sides of the political aisle. So to discuss all this and more, I am excited to have two friends and allies with me here to talk about what's going on. Lawson Bader is the president and CEO of Donors Trust. That makes him my boss for those keeping score at home. And he, of course, has appeared a couple times previously on the podcast for similar discussions. But today we're also joined by Christy Herrera. She is the new president and CEO of the Philanthropy Roundtable, which is the great premier convener of conservative-leaning foundations and donors, and bring them together to have these conversations and keep philanthropy strong. Christy has come up through the public policy world and has an excellent strategic mind, and we are excited for her to be at the roundtable and excited for both of you to be here today. So let's start with a rapid-fire-ish type of question. So from each of you, what do you think is a trend going on in the philanthropic world that you are most excited about and kind of on the other end of the spectrum that you think is the most dangerous trend in philanthropy right now? And either one of you can kick it off.
I'll go first because I always love these rose and thorn questions. And there are lots of roses and lots of thorns in philanthropy. I think, you know, some of the roses, some of the things that are the most exciting are just the sheer number of tools and resources and vehicles available to encourage charitable giving. I mean, we no longer live in a world where there are only big institutional foundations. We see donors giving through C4s and LLCs and DAFs like Donors Trust. And, you know, what it means is that the conservative donor movement as a whole is getting more creative, more sophisticated, and I think most importantly, more entrepreneurial in their giving. Now, with the thorns, do we have 3 hours to talk about all of the threats on charitable giving? Probably not, but you know, just a couple of top lines for me. I am super concerned about donor privacy, and we are seeing donor privacy being attacked not only from the left, but also from the right. You have these growing number of populist voices who are saying, we want to take down big philanthropy and we want to use the force of government to do it. That is not being principled. That is dangerous. Listen, you know, all of the threats to philanthropy and charitable giving from the right are very short-sighted, and they will be the most harmful to our causes, to liberty-oriented groups. Not to mention, you know, all of the people who rely on normal, everyday charities for the things that they care about. Lawson, I could go on and on, but I'm sure you have.
Yeah, the mistake of letting women, well, ladies first, is she took my ideas. yes, I think just as with many aspects of culture, on the thorn phrase, to use your phrasing, there is this overarching, increasing politicalization on the institutions of philanthropy. So we're seeing more conversations about legislating this and regulating that, more public shaming of donors and groups that you disagree with, and sort of the politics of anger and revenge, which I'd argue have been around and increasing really since the Citizens United Supreme Court case over 10 years ago. Those have now morphed into politics of envy. So what used to be, you know, what's yours is yours and what's mine is mine, generally speaking, that mentality is now what's yours should also be mine, or worse, what's yours did not come to you fairly or equitably and should be taken away. So this movement, for example, towards viewing the charitable tax deduction as a government subsidy, I think encapsulates that attitude. So that's just a big picture concern I have. I think on the opposite side, we're seeing engagement. We sometimes think of the word philanthropic and philanthropy as just being dollars. But the reality is it involves the old saying, talent, treasure and time. And so people are engaged. They're volunteering. They're participating. Even younger people, and we might get to this, who aren't necessarily perhaps giving at the same dollar amount they used to, they're very involved in social media and other efforts to sort of speak up for something that matters to them. Now, I'm concerned about free speech issues, but the point is this Tocquevillian sense of you're a citizen, get engaged, I think is actually an increasing thing and viewed favorably. How we do it perhaps is a different question. So I think we are being philanthropic. We're just perhaps being more philanthropic with our time and voice than necessarily our dollars.
I want to go back to something Christy said about these attacks from the right. Is there anything we can do? I mean, of course, there's always something we can do. What should we be doing to try to counter some of those and try to actually show the power of philanthropy to people who we would think would be natural allies for that idea?
I mean, gosh, this is a tale as old as time. And we will always have these voices that say just what Lawson talked about. I'm angry and now I have power and I'm going to go after the people who I disagree with, which obviously doesn't work when you're not in power. Right. So this power is going to be very short lived. I feel like we need to demonstrate how some of these attacks will hurt broader giving. I mean, you alluded to this in your intro, Peter, but, middle class giving and the number of people giving has been on the decline for a while now. And, I worry how donor disclosure efforts could worsen that problem. When you expose donors and their giving for the purpose of harassing them and shaming them, it doesn't hurt the big guys who have PR teams that can handle it. It hurts the little guys, the everyday middle class givers who will put their money elsewhere as a result. So I think we need to show a direct connection between what these regulations say on paper and what they will mean for small nonprofits, conservative organizations that will be hurt as a result.
Yeah, I have a working theory that the decline that we're seeing in smaller and middle level donors is actually a double problem. It's so much praise is given to these mega gifts that it seems like you can't do anything with your dollars. And then it's what you said, Christy, that they also see these mega donors getting attacked for everything they do. And they're like, well, I don't want that. I got a family to feed. I'm not going to worry about that.
That's exactly right. I mean, who wants to get picketed at their place of business? Just be giving to the causes that you care about. And that has been a real problem since we've seen the rise of donor disclosure. So, yeah, I mean, the attacks are coming from the right and the left. They're coming from Washington and in states all across the country, and they're not going to let up.
Peter, there's a particularly specific problem related to your question that I think can be addressed, and that is the significant turnover we have seen at the congressional staff level and even among the regulatory agencies of individuals who are in the process of crossing the T's and dotting the I's when it comes to this regulatory legislative activity. They don't know anything about the history of giving in this country. They don't know anything about the different vehicles that are out there. And so they're acting to a certain extent in a vacuum. They're reacting to their bosses who are, angry, et cetera. And there is something that can be done to get them to understand how the systems have worked, how the systems have been designed. That does not mean there can't be changes, but your average Hill staffer writing a piece of legislation to affect donor advised funds or private foundations doesn't actually know anything about how those actually operate. And so there's a certain educational aspect that can be done. It is being done, not just on the unintended consequences, but to recognize some of these problems have actually been addressed because of how the structures currently are. Donor privacy matters universally, doesn't necessarily benefit one over the other, for example. So we can do a little bit of lobbying on sort of the nature of this industry that I think would be useful.
So let's pivot over to something that the donors are angry about, not just legislators. So a couple episodes ago, I had a conversation with Hans Zeiger of the Jack Miller Center, who I know both of you know. We chatted about alternative ways that donors could be supporting higher education, you know, academia, et cetera, because so many of them are so mad at higher education right now. Christy, I know the philanthropic approach to higher ed is a big topic around the round table. What do you think higher ed donors should be thinking right now? And I guess more importantly, what should they be doing with those dollars they've got for higher ed?
Well, we have had hundreds of these conversations over the past year. And the through line of all of those conversations is that donors are fed up. And this is the $500 donor to the nine-figure donor. They're all telling me the same thing. Like, we're investing all of this money, and these colleges and universities are still failing at their fundamental jobs. Like, we're not asking for much. We just want kids to, you know, be prepared for the workforce and not be totally brainwashed to hate America. Just want some simple things. And so, you know, with all of this groundswell, we just launched at the Roundtable our Higher Education Donor Services Initiative, which does a couple of key things. One, we want to help donors protect their donor intent. We want to help donors advance their values. And we just want to help donors be more effective in their giving to higher education. And what that means practically and on the ground is, what happens now? We've had these dust-ups at Penn and at Harvard and all of these other schools. And they ask, you know, what should we be doing now with our giving? And we tell them that, yeah, you should keep giving to higher ed, but do it in a way that makes it worthy of the name of higher education. And so I just want to go through a couple pieces of advice that we give donors, which I think will be really useful for your audience. The first is to please ditch your alma mater if you need to. The days of giving out of nostalgia are over. And that's going to mean taking your money elsewhere to fund institutions and leaders who are committed to the values we share, like free speech and intellectual diversity. There are a lot of places where you can do this. University of Florida is a great example with what Ben Sasse is doing. I'm an alum of Florida State. I can't believe I'm advocating giving to the Gators, but you know, stranger things have happened. Pano Canellos and what he's doing at UATX. Listen, competition is an awesome thing. If Harvard loses $1 billion in donations from graduates, that is one thing. But if those graduates, if the alumni give that $1 billion very loudly to another institution, Harvard is going to feel the heat. We also tell donors to fund individuals and ideas and not institutions. I was talking with a very astute and bright professor at Princeton, and he recently told me that unrestricted gifts are the work of the devil, which I could not agree more. You know, no one wants to see your dollars fund something that you hate, like DEI. So instead of giving to institutions, support specific scholars or centers that directly align with your values, because guess what? It is going to be much, much harder for those colleges and universities to co-opt that money. And finally, we're telling donors to advocate for reform from the outside. We have seen so many donors pull their gifts from higher ed, and that's great. But the end result of that is a splash of publicity that lasts for a few news cycles. But if that same donor directs their money to an advocacy group that ongoing highlights the university's failings, well, we're going to start to create pressure for the school to change. I'm thinking about the Alumni Free Speech Alliances, Heterodox, FIRE. You know, the goal shouldn't be just forcing out university presidents, although it has been wonderful to see. We need to be empowering students and faculty and alumni to demand the real change that we need over the long run.
And Lawson, I'm sure you have some additional thoughts, but could you also mention what Donors Trust does in terms of higher ed giving?
Sure. You mean in terms of what our policy is?
Yeah.
I think that's an important question. So obviously Donors Trust, just like any DAF sponsor, is going to make gifts to a university, public, private, et cetera. However, We will not make a general operating gift to any college, be it, you know, Hillsdale or the University of Florida, or more importantly, Florida State, right, Christy? And the reason for that has to do with our insistence on protecting donor intent. Once you make that gift to a large institution, you lose all ability to sort of influence how it, where it should be used. So instead, we will make strategic gifts and targeted gifts to a particular program, a student, a faculty member, therefore somewhat tying the hands of the university to be able to do something with it. We also will oftentimes take over a pledge that has been made between perhaps an account holder and an institution of higher education. We will control that pledge and make sure it's being used for purposes that make sense. So our message is to all of our conservative givers, you know, you can rethink what you want to do with your alma mater, but at a minimum, do not just give them carte blanche to do something with it. That's a waste of time and resources.
So let's go back to the legislative front for a minute. You know, there was a lot of talk about the ACE Act. Lawson, last time you and I recorded the podcast, it was a big, big focus of what we talked about. That accelerating charitable initiatives or whatever it stood for seems to be dead in the water. It's just kind of gone the way of the dodo. Nobody's talking about it anymore. Instead, the IRS has jumped in to fill the void and said, hey, we'll do some rules. We'll make up some stuff, particularly around donor advised funds. Lawson, you know, we talked a lot about the legislators and banged on them early in the conversation, so we don't have to get too deep in it. But tell us about what the IRS is trying to do and what we should be concerned about with that.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. This whole thing seems to feel like whack-a-mole at times. It may be a different mole popping up, but they do pop up. So in December of this last year, the Treasury Department issued what will be the first of likely several sort of series of regulatory actions that are interpreting the original statute in 2006 that actually, among other things, codified donor advised funds. So yes, 18 years later, they're sort of getting to Part B. Welcome to government. This first round of regulations, though, are definitional. So they're trying to clarify what is meant by the term donor or donor advised funds, as opposed to a prescriptional one, i.e., you know, thou shall or thou shalt not do something. So anybody who knows anything about regulatory activity understands the devil is always in the details. In my earlier career, I spent a year as part of a consortium of nonprofit groups who were defense contractors trying to get legislators to change and insert the word and into a regulatory process, because by not having that word and, those groups were not allowed to bid on certain processes. So literally a year for and. Here we have the same problem. The government is trying to be very specific about what it considers a donor advised fund, what it doesn't consider a donor advised fund. If a fund has multiple donors, for example, but only one advisor, well, then maybe it's not a donor advised fund. A fund that gives to only one charity is not a donor advised fund. On the other hand, an endowment, a nonprofit that has a team or a committee of people, of trustees who are deciding to make grants, that may now be considered a donor advised fund. The one area that has really raised the most hackles is the Treasury's treatment of outside financial advisors who may be managing assets associated with a donor advised fund account. You know, briefly, for sort of your audience, one of the benefits of having a DAF is those funds can be managed. They can be put into the market. You can take advantage of all those returns. And that initial gift of $10,000 to your donor advised fund in 3 years is $20,000. And the charity is what benefits that. Well, by treating a financial advisor who is not an advisor to the account as somebody who might have privileges, that means you can no longer pay that. You can't pay a fee to that advisor anymore. So you're really upending the whole relationship between donor advised funds and financial planners. And the problem with all of this is when you clarify definition, you're really sending a signal of what you can now regulate and how that's coming down the pike. And so the other problem, Peter, is that all these rules would be retroactive in the year in which they are put into effect, which means they're put into effect, virtually every donor advised fund provider in the country would be out of compliance automatically. And so the concern is this could have a deleterious effect on donor advised funds, how they act, the ability of a donor or the desire of a donor to use a donor advised fund if there's now kinds of restrictions. So I will say this is maybe a rare time of uniformity and unanimity among the donor advised fund community that the government is perhaps overstepping. And as I alluded to earlier, is making assumptions about things that it actually doesn't know a lot about. Now, I would caution you that the ACE Act, I would not say is dead on arrival. Mr. Biden's newest budget proposal has a couple of pieces in there that were part of the original ACE Act, meaning how private foundations relate to a donor advised fund, require payouts for DAF. So it's still simmering. It's still there. But the bigger concern right now is this regulatory proposed changes that really have a lot of donor advised funds and financial advisors very concerned.
You know, this may be a little tinfoil hatty, but do we think that some of these regulations are just out of ignorance, not understanding it? Or is it let's go crazy and put in some things that we know are going to get killed, like the ex post facto changes and that kind of thing, because what we really want is to have these definitions that we can do all the terrible things that we worry about.
Yes and yes, I think is the answer. There's no question based on the public comments that I've seen. There's a hearing already scheduled for early May, I believe. That the tenor of that is respectful, but somewhat, y'all don't know what you're talking about, kind of a thing. At the same time, you're right. Treasury throws out something, i.e. this financial advisor stuff, which seems so crazy, and everybody concentrates on that. But all of a sudden, they've changed the definition over here, and oops, kind of a thing. The other thing to remember is Treasury and the IRS are particularly famous for putting proposed regulations out and then taking years to actually address them, which means they leave up publicly the proposed regulations, which by default become the de facto regulations because everybody begins to comply with them. So one of the big pushes right now is if you're not actually going to do this, if this is truly proposed, then take them down the moment this hearing is over so that you don't unintentionally, either maliciously or not maliciously, influence behavior.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on something you said, Lawson, which is this foot in the door with these current regs from Treasury IRS. We are also waiting for forthcoming regulation that was initiated in 2017. And if you think that the current proposed regs are bad, wait till you see what is going to happen when the 2017 proposed regs come out. I mean, that is something that will kneecap the charitable sector. I mean, we're talking about limiting the way that private foundations use DAFs, which, you know, by the way, foundations give to DAFs for very good reasons, like, you know, ensuring their anonymity when they give to a controversial cause. The forthcoming regs are also going to address something called the public support test, which is a very nerdy and wonky policy thing for like 99% of people. But the bottom line for that is, can anonymous DAF contributions be counted towards a nonprofit's public support test? And in our opinion, absolutely they should, or else we're going to risk the formation of so many new charities. Lawson, you mentioned the Biden budget having some ACE Act stuff in it. But I want to also end with a little bit of bad news, which is that the Accelerating Charitable Efforts Act, so-called Accelerating Charitable Efforts Act, is going to be coming back this Congress in a more limited form. But we have heard that it will include limiting how foundations can use DAFs, new donor disclosure requirements for DAFs, changing the tax treatment of things like complex assets that is going to make it less appealing for you to donate things like closely held stock or real estate. And then these attacks on family foundations with working family members. I mean, this is the most egregious form of discrimination that we've seen in a long time in the Hill, which is you have a family foundation, you're a working family member meeting with your grantees on the ground, doing the hard work of the foundation. The work that you do should not be considered charitable. Yeah. Simply because of your last name.
And it wouldn't be part of the 5% payout requirement too, right?
It wouldn't be part of the 5% payout requirement. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that is going to be something in the new ACE Act. So, you know, we were successful in killing that legislation, donors trust in the roundtable and a whole host of organizations, but it is coming back with a vengeance.
Peter, the scary part of this is you almost see an attempt to create a professional foundation staff. that, you know, the family can't be involved, even though they're the wealth creator. You know, we are the ones as the staff who will come in to do all this, because, and again, you're getting into the institutions of philanthropy and changing at a level that I think fundamentally changes how people view their giving in the first place. And that's the concern.
Yeah. It starts to make the donor intent, whatever the professional schools That's right. push out, instead of what the actual family wants, which is terrible. And, you know, a lot of this comes from, you mentioned the word envy earlier, Lawson. I mean, this concern that something's got to get done with that money, and otherwise that money's just going to sit around forever. Now, in the conservative world, we've actually seen kind of the opposite problem. Conservatives seem to want to give their money away, and we're actually seeing foundations, big foundations, close their doors. We saw Simon Foundation sunset last year. The Cyril Freedom Trust will sunset next year. I believe the DeVos Foundation, at least Rich and Helen's Foundation, is closing or will close soon. And there's Olin, there's Earhart, there's all these other big foundations that have kind of come and gone. We're all in favor of sunsetting. We believe that's really important. But do either of you have any concern we're shooting ourselves in the foot by not allowing, or not allowing? Certainly there are perpetual foundations on our side, but the trend on our side is much more, let's get the money out there now. Is that a risk?
I mean, not all foundations are sunsetting. I think about strong protectors and defenders of donor intent. The Daniels Fund is a really great example of taking Bill Daniels's vision and keeping it alive with every single thing that they do. You know, we at the Roundtable don't take an official position on sunsetting, but we do agree that giving while living is a really smart way to protect your donor intent and ensure to, you know, ensure that your giving is supporting your values. And we've seen mission drift too many times. And that's why, you know, we talked about this earlier, all of the vehicles like DAFs and LLCs, those are tools that we can use and should use to support conservative causes. You know, foundations are not the only option. And, you know, we just ended a conversation about philanthropic freedom, but that is why our job one at the Roundtable is philanthropic freedom. You know, we are the only place, not only in philanthropy, but also in the conservative movement, to have an entire policy and advocacy team in Washington and in state capitals all across the country that is solely dedicated to protecting all of the ways that you can give and to fight against, you know, what the bad guys are trying to do to tear down conservative giving. And I think that is a big piece of what is going to strengthen conservative values and our movement in the long run.
You know, picking up on something Christy just said, the rise of donor advised funds and LLCs as charitable tools has been astronomical the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years in particular. And there's lots of reasons for that. There are definitely many individuals, conservatarian types, who are choosing not to create a private foundation for various reasons, but instead to create a donor advised fund. That data is sometimes hard to see. And there are, and there will always be, strong conservative foundations that are institutional, that are not sunsetting, that'll be around. I'd make the argument there's actually a fair amount of sequestering of conservative-oriented funding opportunities within donor-advised funds. That makes it hard for a development officer to understand the who and the what. But I think there's actually a pool that is there. And these are donors that are more strategic about what they are doing and why they are doing. There also are many individuals who have not been historically givers to this sort of conservative libertarian world of philanthropy and policy type organizations, but because of either just being angry or whatever, have sort of raised their hand to say, you know, it's more than just supporting a national issue such as abortion or their church, and instead it's focused on something at the state level or the national level, which is why we have seen so much of an increase in giving for state-based efforts the last couple of years over, I think, sometimes national efforts. So, yeah, you're right, Peter, that there is a sunsetting. It sometimes can appear that we're shooting one hand to save the other, even though the reasons for it are good. But I'd actually argue there are a lot more dollars there and still a lot of people who are engaged who are coming to the battle now in a way that had not been there before.
And coming and going. I mean, there's always people opening new funds, even as some spend out. And et cetera. So, all right, good. I won't worry about that one anymore then. Thanks, guys. All right. So one last question, focus more on the a bit near term. It's an election year. You may have heard, don't know. What do you think the noise of this election cycle is going to do to charitable giving, and what should it do? Do you think it's going to have any positive impact, particularly in the spaces we care about of public policy and conservative thought, et cetera?
All right, Krista, you go first.
Okay.
I mean, I'll go first, but you can go first.
Well, yeah, I can go first. You know, it is a very well-known thing that charitable giving goes down in election years. And that is understandable, right? Elections are important, but it is equally important for donors to recognize just how effective charitable giving can be at advancing your values and your worldview outside of the realm of politics. You know, a big initiative that we have at the Roundtable is called our Values-Based Giving Initiative. And it allows donors to find great charities on the ground that put their values at the heart of what they do. And we have new donors coming into our network all of the time. And a lot of them are big political donors. And we tell them, you know, yes, giving to candidates is important, but you need to make sure that your charitable giving isn't working cross purposes to those values. And that is why we say, you know, philanthropy is the long game. You know, Lawson mentioned earlier the politicization of philanthropy, which has been, you know, really horrible to the concept of free speech, thinking about, you know, me expressing my view on an issue is somehow politics and electioneering, and you have to apply, you know, all kinds of political disclosure requirements on that speech. We can't forget, too, that policy philanthropy is critical to creating the conditions for freedom. You know, we're not just supporting philanthropy because we think philanthropy is cool. It is, but we support philanthropy because it is what brings about freedom, you know, not only in that Tocquevillian sense, but also in the policy groups and think tanks and research centers where freedom is advanced every day. And so, yeah, you know, we like to say that charitable giving supports the R&D for policymakers. It's what elected officials need to help them make informed decisions. So we need all of it.
I might push back a little bit on some of the assumptions that we've seen that historically charitable giving goes down in election year. What I have seen is people are being more specific how they delineate their political giving, i.e. C4 PAC money, from their charitable contributions. I would argue when I was at Mercatus and even CEI that we saw a little bit of an ebb and flow between, I'm not going to support you, CEI. I'm instead going to give that $25,000 to a particular candidate because it's an election year. I've seen that change to where money's going into both at a fairly high level. What I do think changes is where it goes in the policy community when, quote unquote, your team is no longer in power, whatever that happens to mean. So we see increases in litigation efforts, for example, when your team is not in power and this is how you affect the team. And this goes both directions. So, you know, in 2016, you know, we had a major change. There have been a lot of money going into groups before then. There was a lot of money going after. There's a lot of money going into groups right now. And I suspect next year you'll see a continuation of that charitable giving. It's a question of where it is going. And that becomes the bigger question, you know, which groups are positioned to be able to capitalize on opportunity, which ones are not. And that's, I think, going to be a challenge to CEOs and development directors to sort of follow that and to see. On the other hand, I just would add, I think there's a skepticism now of power across the board and a skepticism to put dollars into a candidate, a political effort, rather than taking a long game. And I think there's some hand-wringing over that as well. So the landscape is changing. I don't think the dollars are changing. It's where they're going.
Well, we covered the waterfront. We touched on a bunch of issues. Is there anything we didn't touch on that either of you want to briefly flag?
We don't want to go back to Florida State. FS, you know, University of Florida. Right. I can throw in some ACC comments just to make it interesting, but.
No, I mean, I think, you know, just like last word for me is it is a really rough world out there for donors who share our values. And that is why the work that Donors Trust is doing is so important. It's why the work the Roundtable is doing is so important, because we are it. You know, we are the people standing in the way between the donors who share our values and the people that want to tear them down. And I really encourage, you know, everyone in your community and our community to stand strong, because our ideas are winning, and we will show truly what civil society can do with the power of charitable giving. So keep at it.
Yeah. Philanthropic freedom is a tenet of our historical preservation and our history, and is woven into that fabric. And we need to understand that any attack on it, any attempt to influence what it really is, a very important independent source of power, is detrimental to everybody, not just policy community. It's detrimental to religious institutions, the arts, culture, all those things that make society and our neighborhoods rich. Yes, stay strong, but recognize that when we defend philanthropic freedom, we have to defend it universally. And that means sometimes strange bedfellows, but this is the time for that.
Excellent closing points from both of you. Thank you so much for having this conversation. We got lots of work to do, but there's a lot of promise too.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us, Peter.
I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did, and I hope you found it valuable. When you're focused on being a giver, it's easy to lose sight of what is going on all around you in the broader charitable landscape. But taking a peek at the social, political, economic, and regulatory aspects of it is good to do every once in a while. That way you can better understand the full picture of the work you are doing in your own charitable giving. Understanding that context, I think, can really enrich your own giving. You can learn more about the Philanthropy Roundtable at its website, philanthroparoundtable.org. Donors Trust, of course, is at donorstrust.org, and both of these organizations exist to serve you as a right-leaning, liberty-minded donor who's committed to having real, positive, and lasting impact with your charitable dollars. We will be back in 2 weeks with another great conversation, returning to the usual mode of highlighting groups around a theme. Subscribe to Giving Ventures in your favorite podcast player so you get the next episode as soon as it is delivered. Until then, thank you so much for being a giver. Let's talk more soon.